choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine.
Can I be locked? Okay, I'm out.
How does it feel for the United States to be the new record holder?
At last, huh?
When that baby light, there's no doubt about it.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Listen, tranquility base here. The Eagle has landed.
That's one small step for man. One giant leap for mankind.
Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode 160 of the Space Rocket History Podcast. And now, Apollo 8, The Decision. An Apollo 8 lunar orbital mission was not part of the original schedule of flights. The first formal discussions of the mission began on September 20, 1967, when George Low and others met with top manned space flight officials in Washington, D.C. to present the center's plan, the key features of which was the need for additional lander and Saturn V developmental flights and the incorporation of an Apollo 8-style lunar orbital flight in the schedule. The chief of the Lunar Module Engineering Office, Owen Maynard, presented plans for scheduling seven types of missions that would lead step by step to the ultimate goal. He described these steps A through G as follows. An A-type mission would be flown with a Saturn V and be used to test the launch vehicle, spacecraft, and a high-velocity lunar return. NASA covered the A mission with Apollo 4 and 6. A B-type mission would be flown with a Saturn 1B and test the lunar module development and propulsion and launch vehicle staging. This was accomplished with Apollo 5. A C-type mission would be flown with a Saturn 1B and test the command and service module and evaluate the crew performance in low Earth orbit. This was accomplished with Apollo 7. A D-type mission would be flown with either a Saturn 1B or a 5 to evaluate the lunar module, command and service modules, and crew performance in low Earth orbit. An E-type mission would be flown with a Saturn 5 and used to evaluate command, service, and lunar modules in high Earth orbit and last up to 11 days. An F-type mission would be flown with a Saturn V and used for lunar orbit evaluation of the lunar module. And finally, the G-type mission would be a landing on the moon. Continuing with the meeting, Apollo Program Manager Phillips ask that the group consider carefully both the pros and cons of flying an additional Saturn V flight. Wernher von Braun and George Low favored the flight. Von Braun because he felt the launch operations people would need the experience, and Low because he believed that data from several flights would be needed to make certain that the big booster was indeed ready for its flight to the moon. Against these opinions, Phillips cited the tremendous workload an added flight would place on the pre-flight crews at Kennedy, and George Miller reminded the meeting of the already crowded launch schedule for 1968. An additional lunar module mission would be flown only if lunar module number one was unsuccessful. But most discussion centered on the insertion of an Apollo 8-style lunar orbital flight into the schedule. Houston wanted to evaluate deep space environment and to develop procedures for the entire lunar landing mission, short of the lunar module descent, ascent, and surface operations. Miller remarked that he regarded the lunar orbit mission as just as hazardous as the landing mission. But the Texas group argued that they had no intention of flying the vehicle closer to the moon than 15 kilometers. They pointed out that the crew would not have to train for the actual landing, but it would give them a chance to develop the procedures for getting into lunar orbit and undocking and for rendezvous that the lunar landing crew would need. Miller said Apollo should not go to the moon to develop procedures, but Lowe reminded him that crew operations would not be the main reason for the trip. There was still a lot to be learned about communications, navigation, and thermal control in deep space. Although a final decision on the lunar orbital mission was not made until later, Owen Maynard's seven-step plan was generally adopted throughout NASA. Plenty of wrinkles remained to be ironed out, but by the end of 1967, Apollo seemed to be rounding the corner toward its ultimate goal, despite the most tragic event that manned U.S. spaceflight had encountered so far. Almost as soon as NASA adopted Owen Maynard's alphabetical stairway for reaching the moon in progressive flights, with the seventh, or G step, representing the ultimate goal, mission planners had begun looking for ways to omit a letter. In late 1967, when the ABC scheme evolved, George Lowe and Flight Operations Director Chris Kraft had pushed for a lunar orbital mission as soon as possible to learn more about communications, navigation, and thermal control in deep space. In the spring of 1968, Apollo officials in Houston were trying to upgrade the E mission, operating the command module and the lander in high Earth orbit, into something called E prime, which would move the mission to the vicinity of the moon. But by August, Gilruth and others had concluded that Lunar Module Number 3 would not be ready for flight that year. This finding left NASA with two excellent command modules, 101 and 103, but no lunar module could be manned in 1968. Lowe reasoned that the Saturn V 503 and the Command Service Module 103 might be used for a circumlunar or lunar orbit flight. Lowe kept his own counsel for a while, waiting for the Saturn V POGO problem to be resolved. Then, on August 7th, Lowe asked Chris Kraft to work out a flight plan for such a mission during 1968. This is how Kraft described the event in his book titled Flight, My Life in Mission Control. George Lowe entered my office and said, "Chris, I've got an idea about the moon. Do you have time to see Bob Gilruth with me?" We walked down the hall to Gilruth's office. Bob was expecting us, and George started by going through a laundry list of lunar module problems. He didn't see any way that we could have an all-up stack Saturn V topped with a command and service module and a lunar module before February or March 1969. There had been some problems with the big Saturn V in the two unmanned test flights also, but those seemed to be under control. Finally, he got to the point. "What do you think about flying to the moon without a lunar module? If Apollo 7 does okay in October, can we juggle the schedule to fly a crew to the moon and back in December?" His idea was a shocker. Gilruth leaned forward, elbows on his desk, and asked for more details. "What kind of lunar mission? Just out and back, a circumlunar trip?" "Yes, that's what I'm thinking," George Lowe said. "It would ace the Russians and take a lot of pressure off Apollo, and we have to go there sooner or later anyway. I don't think it makes much sense to fly twice in Earth orbit if we can go around the moon." Gilruth reached for his phone. We've got to get Deke Slayton in here. Once Slayton arrived, the meeting continued. Chris, can you get the control center, the controllers, and the software ready for December? Deke, what about a crew? Can you give us a trained crew in 4 months? Deke was both quick and careful. Yeah, I think so, but Chris and I need to look at it real careful. Give us a day. Take two, Gilruth said. In the hallway, Deke was almost bouncing with anticipation. I think I'll have to do some crew swapping. I gotta make some calls. End quote. On August 9th, George Lowe informed MSC Director Gilruth about his ideas for a lunar orbit mission. Gilruth, too, was enthusiastic, and he and Lowe started calling Washington, Huntsville, and the Cape to set up a meeting that same afternoon at Marshall. Lowe next talked to Kraft, who said the mission was feasible from a ground control and spacecraft computer standpoint. Gilruth, Lowe, Kraft, and Flight Crew Operations Director Deke Slayton then boarded a plane for Huntsville. At 2:30 p.m., they were joined by Kennedy Director Kurt DeBoos, Rocco Patrone, Program Manager Phillips, and George Haig. They were met by Werner von Braun, Eberhard Ries, Luddy G. Richard, and Lee James. Lowe said that a lunar orbit mission, if it could be flown in December, might be the only way to meet the fast-approaching lunar landing deadline. This remark sparked a lively discussion. The talk was mostly about what each of the NASA elements would have to do to make the mission possible in the time remaining. DeBoos and Patrone considered Kennedy's workload and concluded they could be ready by December 1. Von Braun, Reeves, James, and Richard reported that they had nearly solved the POGO problem, and Lowe and Gilruth talked about the differences between command modules 103 and 106 and what to use as a substitute for the lander. Even as he joined in the discussion, Apollo Program Director Phillips had been taking notes. He said they should keep their plans secret until a decision was made by NASA's top officials. In the meantime, while gathering whatever information was needed, they would use the code name SAMS Budget Exercise as a cover. The group would meet in Washington on August 14th, Decision Day. Administrator James Webb and Miller would be in Vienna attending the United Nations Conference on the Exploration and Peaceful Uses of Outer Space at that time. If the Washington meeting decided in favor of the lunar orbit mission, Phillips would fly to Austria to sell the idea to Webb and Miller. In Houston, at 8:30 that evening, Lowe met with spacecraft chiefs Kenneth Kleinnick and Bolander, technical assistant George Abey, and North American Apollo manager Dale Myers. Kleinnick began studying the differences between spacecraft 103 and 106. Spacecraft 106 was the first spacecraft originally scheduled to go to the moon. Kleinnick needed to compare the two spacecraft to determine what changes needed to be made so spacecraft 103 could go to the moon. Bolander left for Bethpage to find a substitute for Lunar Module 3, and Myers went back to Downey to make sure that the command module 103 was moving along and to oversee any changes Kleinnick recommended. Joseph Katanchik, structures expert in Houston, could not see any reason for Bolander's trip to Bethpage. A simple crossbeam could be used for weight and balance, he said. But Kachanchik found himself alone in his position. Others believed that a true facsimile should be carried, and Lowe decided on a lunar test article. Early on Monday morning, August 12th, Kraft told Lowe that the target date would have to be December 20th if they wanted to launch in daylight. If the flight had to be terminated for any reason shortly after launch, good visibility was necessary for recovering the spacecraft. In the meantime, Slayton had been thinking about which crew to pick for the flight. Frank Borman's team had been training for a high-altitude mission. Slayton talked with Borman over the weekend and decided to propose that crew at the meeting in Washington. The 12 men who had gathered in Huntsville were joined by William Snyder and Julian Bowman when they met with Deputy Administrator Thomas Paine at headquarters on Wednesday, August 14th. George Lowe reviewed spacecraft status, Chris Kraft discussed flight operations, and Deke Slayton talked about flight crew preparations. Von Braun reported that the Saturn could be ready for the launch, and he and Eberhard Ries agreed that Lowe had made a good selection of a stand-in for the lunar module. DeBus and Patron said the Cape could launch the Saturn V by December 6th. After listening to the managers, Deputy Administrator Paine decided to play devil's advocate. "Not too long ago," he said, "you people were trying to decide whether it was safe to man the third Saturn V, number 503. And now you want to put men on top of it and send them to the moon." Paine then asked for comments. This is what he heard. Wernher von Braun said, "Once you decided to man 503, it did not matter how far you went." Haig said, "There are a number of places in this mission where decisions can be made and risk minimized." Deke Slayton said, "It is the only chance to get to the moon before the end of 1969. DeBus said, "I have no technical reservations." Rocco Patron said, "I have no reservations." Bowman said, "It will be a shot in the arm for manned space flight." James said, "Manned safety in this and following flights will be enhanced." Richard said, "Our lunar capability will be advanced by flying this mission." Snyder said, "The plan has my wholehearted endorsement." Gilruth said, "Although this may not be the only way to meet our goal, it does increase the possibility. There is always risk, but this is a path of less risk. In fact, the minimum risk of all Apollo plans." Chris Kraft said, "Flight operations will have a difficult job here. We need all kinds of priorities. It will not be easy to do, but I have confidence. But it should be a lunar orbit and not a circumlunar flight." And finally, George Lowe said, "Assuming Apollo 7 is a success, there is no other choice." So ended the roundtable vote by the men who managed the day-to-day details of the Apollo program to commit the first crew to fly to the moon. Paine was impressed, but he was the first of the three top men who had to be convinced. Webb and Miller would not be so easy to sell. In fact, when Miller called Phillips from Vienna during the meeting and learned of the plan, he was not receptive. He urged Phillips not to come to Vienna. By the next day, August 15th, he had warmed to the idea, but he wanted Phillips to keep it quiet until after Apollo 7. Webb was shocked by the audacity of the proposal and was inclined to say no immediately. After talking with Phillips and Paine, however, he asked for more information. Paine called Willis Shapley, Julian Shear, and Phillips in to draft a text for Webb. Paine's cable to Vienna on August 15th underlined his complete support and included an item-by-item schedule of necessary actions. The cable also contained a draft of a statement for Webb to make in Vienna and a draft of a press release to be issued in Washington. Altogether, the cablegram covered 7 typewritten pages. After discussing the proposal with Miller, Webb cabled Payne on August 16th that he believed it unwise for any announcements to originate from Vienna. Webb told his deputy to plan for the lunar orbit flight, but to make no public statement about it. In other words, NASA could not talk about anything but an Earth orbital mission. Webb also asked Payne to notify the White House and the President's scientific advisors about any drastic changes in mission planning. This was not what the planners had asked for, but it was certainly more than Webb had given them the previous day. Now they had to figure out how to stay within the constraints set by the administrator and still get everything ready for a lunar orbit mission if the approval came later. Phillips called Lowe, saying he would be in Houston the next day to decide how to handle the situation. Phillips and Haig arrived in Houston on August 17th and met with Gilruth, Lowe, Kraft, and Slayton. The Apollo program leader from Washington said that Webb had given him clear authority to prepare for a December 6 launch, to designate it as a Type C Prime mission, and to call it Apollo 8. He then ticked off what else had been authorized. They could assign Borman's crew to the flight, equip and train it to meet the December 6 launch, and speak of the flight as Earth orbital while continuing to plan for a lunar orbit mission. The managers were well aware, and Phillips re-emphasized it, that a successful command module qualification flight in Earth orbit by Apollo 7 was the key to the first lunar flight being approved for 1968. Now Houston had to train crews to fly that mission, as well as the others that would follow. Salutations from the foothills of North Carolina. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode 160 of the Space Rocket History Podcast, entitled Apollo 8, The Decision, Part 1. Space Rocket History is a proud member of the History Podcasters and the Tech Podcasting Network. I want to give a big shout out for all my longtime listeners. Thanks for staying subscribed. And extend a warm welcome to my new listeners. I'm glad you're here. Today we salute my MIR level donors. These donors give $80 or more during a calendar year. Thank you for your continued support, MIR donors. Had a few afterthoughts, of course. I hope I made it clear that the Apollo 8 mission was originally intended to be an Earth orbital mission. The decision that we're talking about now was changing it to a lunar orbital mission. Now, a word on Owen Maynard's stair steps to the moon. This was a little hard to explain just by words. So I posted in Facebook and Twitter a table explaining Maynard's steps, A through G, that NASA would use to make the first lunar landing. So if any of my verbal explanation didn't make sense, please go look at the table. I've got it on the website, spacerockethistory.com, and it would be much easier to understand with the visual aid. Also, I hope everyone understands that the events in this episode occurred before the Apollo 7 flight. So the idea for Apollo 8 and the tentative approval were made before the launch of Apollo 7 and were contingent on Apollo 7 being successful, which of course it was. Speaking of a tentative approval, that has to be one of the most frustrating circumstances to work under. You have to do all the additional work for a lunar orbit mission with a very real possibility you won't be able to fly it. So there's a whole bunch of extra work for a mission that you just might not be able to fly. That's a frustrating thing, and you still have to prepare for the Earth orbital mission too, in case it goes that way. A frustrating condition to work on. But I can understand Administrator Webb's caution. The Apollo 1 fire wasn't that long ago, and Webb had to endure the congressional hearings for that. And the unmanned Saturn V mission developed the POGO problem. And now, Webb's subordinates wanted to fly to the moon on the first manned Saturn V flight. And it appears like it's going to take a rush job to get it done in time. So I can really understand his caution. Okay, that's my thoughts on the issue. Your mileage may vary. Don't miss next week's episode as we get into the possible Soviet influence on the decision to make Apollo 8 a lunar orbital mission. Okay, I've posted some pictures and Owen Maynard's Stair Steps to the Moon table at the homepage, spacerockethistory.com. Check that out. I was pleased to receive several donations to support the podcast over the past week. Pier Luigi from Italy donated at the Apollo level, and since this is his second year donating, he earned the Rocket Emoticon. Thank you, Pier Luigi. Bruce W. from Georgia donated at the Apollo level. Thank you, Bruce. Case W. from Arizona donated at the Apollo level. Thank you, Case. And Mylene M. from California donated at the Sputnik level and earned her Rocket Emoticon for donating 2 years in a row. This brings us to 106 donors for 2016 with a goal of reaching 250. If you are able, please donate to support the podcast. You can make a one-time donation by clicking on the orange donate button on the homepage at spacerockethistory.com, or you can sign up at the Patreon by clicking the Patreon link also on the homepage on the right just below the orange donate button. Or you can donate by check. Just send me an email and I'll give you the address. All donors are rewarded with their name on the donor page on the website, spacerockethistory.com, based on their donation level. To stay updated on the podcast, including previews of next episodes, please follow me on Twitter and Facebook. The links are on the homepage, spacerockethistory.com. I want to thank those who follow me on Twitter. We are now at 589 followers. Thank you very much. And thanks to those who like the Facebook page. This week, we got past 800 likes. Another milestone. I think 801 at the time I'm doing this. I was pleased to see the podcast received a new 5-star rating on iTunes this week. I'd like to thank Sean Brown for the wonderful review and the all-important 5-star rating. Want to encourage everyone to share the podcast. Feel free to link the homepage or a particular episode on all social media. And thanks to those who have already done so, like my retweeters. Jet City Star, 1202 Alarm, Spaceman 944, Andy Cox, Bert at Home, Buddy P. Murphy, Drupal Puppies, E.G. Robert, Futurama King, James 2904, Gaddafi 1202, Just Space Things, Pompeiator, Rapid Mustang, Rensloin, Rocket Noob, Skibby, Stephen Lebowski, Stiggy, This is Alex Boyd, Wondering Star, ATM, Int Arch, CMW Website, Aussie Photo Guy, Jacob Hahn, and Keith Bram. Thank you very much for the retweet. If I missed anybody, let me know and I'll get you next week. This is the end of content for this episode, and I had a few off-topic thoughts. If you're not interested, please feel free to switch to the next podcast. Thanks for sticking around, folks. I hope you enjoyed this episode. As I said, next week we're going to get into the possible Soviet influence on the decision to make Apollo 8 a lunar orbital mission, and that should prove to be very interesting. In personal news, we have a developing story going on. As you may recall, we came home from our trip about 2 weeks early because my daughter was having complications with her pregnancy. Well, I'm glad we did. The complications have gotten worse, and they admitted her to the hospital on Tuesday. It looks like grandson number 4 is going to be several weeks early. His original due date was June 23rd. Now it looks like he could be born within the next 2 weeks or even the next day. If he is born tomorrow, he would be at 34 weeks of development. So he's definitely going to be early. We're just hoping for a healthy mom and baby right now. So I will try to keep those interested informed on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, that's about all the time I have for this week. I hope to have episode 161 up by next week. So long for now.